Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 22nd, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Friday, folks. You know what that means? It's the end of the week. And you know what that means? We look back on this week. Week is horribilis. I don't know what Latin for week is, but you get the picture.
I thought that was a Harry Potter spell.
It may be. I hope not. We're all going to turn into something. Also on the program today, film guy Matthew, because as it is Friday, tomorrow is Saturday. That denotes the weekend. He will give us a suggestion as to what we can watch streaming-wise. Meanwhile, Republicans cannot pass an immigration bill. As thousands of children still missing in the ICE immigration system, and the military is prepping to house 20,000 kids. Also on the program today, the Trump administration rolls out a plan to destroy the safety net and government efficacy. Meanwhile, legislative Republicans want Medicare and Medicaid cut. And we are now entering a new age of right-wing judges deconstructing the administrative state. Pretty proud of myself for voting for a Green New Deal, as we say around here. Betsy DeVos scuttled more than 1,200 civil rights probes. India and China collect or roll out new tariffs in our burgeoning trade war. Melania Trump, morally bankrupt simp or morally bankrupt non-simp? All that and more on today's program. Folks, let me just start by doing this. And look, it's always it always gives me pause. When there's a death and of a public figure who is a fellow communicator, as it were, and whose opinions I did not necessarily agree with. One of those people has died. And there's often, you know, when someone who is in a, you know, I wouldn't say we were in the exact same industry, but certainly, obviously, similar industries. And the idea is that you want to acknowledge their death. And, you know, we are told we should talk about how nice this individual was and how much they helped other people, how they cared for other people, how they expressed, you know, care and this and that.
You may have disagreed politically, but they were had great character.
They had great character or something to this. But here's the thing. I did not know this individual personally ever. I never met this person. I never had any individual reactions. I just saw from afar what they did. Now, this may be controversial for some of you, but I am going to say rest in peace to Coco, the beloved gorilla that learned to communicate using sign language, who has passed away. Was a 46-year-old celebrity ape and a Western lowland gorilla. She died in her sleep earlier this week at the organization's preserve in Northern California. This is the Gorilla Foundation. The Gorilla Foundation is a nonprofit that works to study and protect great apes and said that Coco will be remembered as the primary ambassador for endangered species And one of the things that they also touted about Coco, she never advocated for any type of conflict that resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent people. And so for that, Coco, I say kudos to you. Coco also never said that, you know, horrible things about crack babies and such. So she was a great gorilla. And she and Coco, of course, was just a nickname. Her real name was Hanabi Co.
Well, we can be real, too. Coco did rip a sink off the wall and blame her cat.
She, okay, look, she wasn't perfect. I'm not saying that Coco was perfect in any way. I'm just saying that because she never advocated relentlessly a war of choice that ended up killing hundreds of thousands of civilians, I will say, rest in peace, Coco the gorilla.
Pour one out for Coco.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if she drank. Oh, hey, folks, as you know, learning a language is a journey, and it can be very difficult, super challenging. But it is ultimately one of the most rewarding experiences a person can have. I have never successfully learned a language, but I'm going to start this program as soon as I don't have the kids with me for a couple of days. I'm on full daddy duty. The best way to reach your goal, whether it's a basic understanding or full-on fluency, is to immerse yourself in the language. And finally, there's a way to do that online from the comfort of your home, thanks to LiveLingua. LiveLingua offers immersive online language lessons via Skype. All their instructors are native speakers. They work with you one-on-one. They get you to the level you want to reach, you know, again, whether it's like basic phrases or questions for an upcoming trip or a comprehensive understanding of the language. It is the LiveLingua is the most effective method for actually getting to the level you want to reach. It's not a trendy new gimmick. It's not going to take you 5 minutes a day, you know, where all you got to do is like eat a raw avocado and, you know, whatever it is. And, but they're going to get you there in the most efficient, most comprehensive way. If you're looking to learn one of the most, the 11 most commonly spoken languages, you need a proven approach, and this is it. LiveLingua follows the immersive language learning method that diplomats and educators have used for hundreds of years. But they do it online, so it gives you the opportunity to build a routine and a comfort zone that works for you. On Skype, students work one-on-one with their teacher, meaning there's no intimidation, no looking at the guy in the back of the class who's so good at this. Don't worry about falling behind. Their immersive method increases memorization, finally helps a new language to be part of your life. Listeners of the Majority Report can check out LiveLingua's platform by signing up for a free trial lesson today at LiveLingua.com/majority. That's a free trial lesson. In other words, you pay nothing. LiveLingua's immersive language learning method is convenient, productive, built to meet the needs of each individual student. LiveLingua.com/majority to sign up for your free lesson. All right, let's, you know, a lot of people have gotten really up in arms about this separation of children from their parents. You know what? I'm going to read part of this. This is honestly like one of those stories where it's one of those things where it's going to be tricky to get through. So we're starting to hear now from people who there are lawyers who are specifically authorized to visit these centers and have access to the kids. We're starting to see more and more people speak out from having interaction with some of these kids and some of these separated families. And this is hugely important. And we'll talk later in the program about the huge importance of just even like flight attendants saying to their supervisor, I'm not working on a flight with these kids. I'm just not going to do it. And this is what, you know, very effective pushback. So this is a physician who has been interviewed and actually given a little column space almost in The New Yorker. Her name is Alicia Hart. She has worked as an emergency physician in South Texas for 10 years. She has seen a stream of migrant children from Guatemala and Honduras come to the U.S. fleeing gang violence. In the past, most of her kids in her care were teenagers who crossed the border unaccompanied, ended up in government detention facilities when they were 15, 16, 17, seemed capable of living away from their families. Most of them, according to Hart, were just waiting to be sent to relatives in the U.S. as they were being processed. Okay? I think people can understand that as a unique circumstance. She says, the population I've been starting to see is younger, and it scares me. These are little people, little babies. They are ill-equipped to fend for themselves. They are so totally traumatized, they don't cry like normal kids. They don't interact like normal kids. She goes on to talk about this one kid, an 8-year-old, that she, who needed clearance for psychiatric treatment. The kid was surrounded by 4 escorts, one of whom was an armed police officer. She walked over to the boy, she crouched down and asked him in Spanish, how do you feel? The boy had been in custody for over a month. One of his guardians, these are one of the 4 men, told me that he had been acting out and threatening to harm himself by jumping from his bed. She goes on to say, I couldn't find out any information from this guy because he would say, I'm not at liberty to tell you that and you don't need to know that. We're talking about an 8-year-old boy, right? So she's trying to find out, like, how long has he been away from his parents? Where are his parents, et cetera, et cetera? She said, and he says, you don't need to know that, even though a lot of my questions were relevant to taking care of the child. I was asking things like, where are his parents? And she says, what bothers me is, if you know where this parent is, why can't we not contact them for consent? She's saying this to the other men. They aren't even made aware if their child has an injury, if their child is having a breakdown. These are people who are desperate for a better life and cross the border. Why are their parental rights being taken away? I asked the clinician. This is one of the guys who says they're in charge of the kid. When is this child going to be reunited with his parents? He was evasive. First it was, oh, well, we don't know. And then it was, well, he won't be reunited with his parents unless he behaves. The lack of compassion was scary, and it didn't seem like there was really a plan. This boy seemed devastated, quiet and withdrawn. He barely spoke. I asked him if he needed a hug. I kneeled down in front of the recliner, and this kid just threw himself into my arms and didn't let go. He cried, and I cried. And to think he's been in a facility for a month without a hug, away from his parents and scared, not knowing when he'll see them again or if he'll see them again. While I held him, I heard the man standing behind me muttering that I was, quote, rewarding his bad behavior. Thankfully, it was in English, so I don't think the boy understood what they were saying, but it just revealed their attitudes toward the kids. I referred the boy to an inpatient psychiatric unit for treatment. I worry that he may be treated with psychiatric drugs like antipsychotics, also without the consent of his parents. But I still believe that a psychiatric hospitalization is our best option. If we get these kids to the psychiatrist, at least they're in a protective unit away from these detention facilities where they will get some of the counseling they need because they've been through a tremendous trauma. There are now full-on confirmed reports, according to court documents, that show many of these children have been drugged without any parental consent. This is so effing twisted. And how do you deal with how twisted the situation is and remains? You know, Donald Trump can say that he signed this document. It's not clear what's going to happen in the future. There seems to be no plan whatsoever to even keep records of where these children are going relative to their parents. And as twisted as it is, the stories of these kids being drugged, essentially, without their parents' consent, these kids being holed up for a month plus, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 5-year-olds, toddlers, babies, infants, without their parents. How do you look at yourself in the mirror? How do you tell yourself that this is okay? Particularly if it's your job to pretend that it's okay. What do you do? Well, here is a prime example of it. Here's how Brian Kilmeade deals with it.
It wasn't President Trump's idea to have everyone leave from Central and South America in June and well up at the border. Somebody has to deal with this issue. It doesn't matter who the president is.
Pause
it. If you don't like his...
Now, look, every summer this happens. And it happens because there is horrors that the vast majority of these people are trying to escape. And it's easier to make this trek during this time of the year. That's basically what it comes down to. I mean, if it was all about they're so compelled to come to the United States because of what we offer here, you wouldn't see this level of desperation coming just when they can actually make it. Right? Because it's like, you know, if you're going to go on a vacation, you just go on the vacation. But go.
Somebody has to deal with this issue. It doesn't matter who the president is. If you don't like his policy, he's also trying to open to your policy rather than just criticizing his.
Pause it. Actually, there was a policy in place, and there are multiple. There was a pilot program they shut down where they would release these people and have them in close touch, I think they call it, where they contact them on a regular basis. And they had something like 97% of the people showed up for their hearings. 97%. And they shut that pilot program down, despite it showing its efficacy.
Criticizing his, he's trying to send a message to the other countries. This is not the way you do it, because this is a country that has rules and laws. The port of entry would be one thing. We can bolster those laws.
But pause it. Incidentally, Chris Hayes tweeted out that Jared Kushner's failure to report on his federal disclosure forms is a federal felony. 91% of the people who were prosecuted under this new zero tolerance policy were charged with a misdemeanor. A misdemeanor. Jared Kushner, incidentally, has not been prosecuted for anything, and he certainly hasn't had his children taken from him.
Entry would be one thing. We can bolster those laws, but we just can't let everybody in that wants to be here. And these are not, like it or not, these aren't our kids. Show them compassion. But it's not like he's doing this to the people of Idaho or Texas. These are people from another country, and now people are saying that they're more important than people in our country.
Pause it. Nobody's saying they're more important. All the data shows that immigrants, A, either increase employment for other people, or at the worst, have no impact on employment opportunities. B, they pay more in taxes than they get back in terms of services. Because they end up, whether it's under a fake Social Security number, what, they pay the taxes. So they don't flag themselves as being undocumented. And they certainly don't go and use a wide range of services because they're afraid of being caught. So yeah. Nobody's saying that they're more important.
It's funny how kids in other countries are innocent victims when they're trying to create a rationale for like airstrikes or military acts.
Of course.
And then when they're trying to create a rationale for this, they're all of a sudden these like alien invaders.
Of course. But how, honestly, how sociopathic do you have to be to say like, It's one thing if he was separating the kids from their parents in Texas.
Idaho?
Or Idaho.
Or Texas. These are people from another country, and now people are saying that they're more important than people in our country who are paying taxes who have needs as well.
Yeah. Well, he just wants to make sure we vet who's coming across the border.
There's no way to vet these people at all, and except for to separate them from the children. Unbelievable. All right. You know those 10-month-old. We'll talk about this later. Those 10-month-old MS-13 guys that they send back up. Got to be careful of those.
It's not like
those 8-year-old gang members.
It's not like they're white children. Come on.
You put those guys on Idaho of all places, right?
I'm from North Dakota, and even I think that's a really white state to reference.
All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to this program the proprietor of the Uber blog Hullabaloo, where she is known as Digby, and the writer at Salon.com, where she is known as Heather Digby Parton. Digby and Heather. Hi, Heather Digby.
Hey, Sam. Oh, how yes, are you?
I am.
Happy Friday.
Yeah. What a week. I feel like we say this every time we talk now, but this was really horrific in many respects. And I don't know. You want to just start up and sum up the horrors, and then we can go through them one by one. But. This is, I mean, there's a lot to talk about, and you know, obviously the first order of this stuff is just the horrors of the parents and the children being separated. But there's a lot of implications to this week that I think are going to resonate over the next 6 months, more so than most weeks.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think everybody who's listening probably knows the outlines of what happened. And this horror story down at the border. But there are a couple of things that are probably worth just sort of taking a step back and looking at to explain, you know, number one, why this idea of deterrence is so cruel and absurd. And I really think that hasn't been hammered home enough. I mean, there have been a few commentators who've attempted to sort of put this in perspective. But you know, these people, and you look at if you look at the people who are coming over the border, teenage boys, parents with young kids, for the most part, these are people seeking asylum that they decided to treat as criminals. And, you know, you have to look at what they are, why they are doing this. And you know, their home countries are in the grips of horror. It's the worst violence in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, it is. In fact, one of the great Twitter wags, you know, Pio and all the things. I don't know if you know who that is, but he tweets anonymously, but he's a national security expert, and he tweeted this week, "I would rather backpack through Syria than do the trip that these people take from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala." And, you know, I think that means something. This is an incredibly arduous 2,000-mile journey that these people make, and they're not doing it for nothing. They're not doing it so they can come up and watch Roseanne. I mean, this is, these people are escaping a fate worse than that. That's why they're doing it. So they come to the border, and you know, Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump get it into their heads that if we just make it really tough, we got to be tough. We got to be tough, tough, tough. You know, he said that over and over again this week. Got to be tough. And if we just make it tough enough, they won't come here anymore. Well, that's actually, you know, complete not. They can't make it tougher than killing your teenage boy if he won't join the gang. They can't make it tougher than raping your 8-year-old daughter. They can't make it tougher than killing you and your husband. This is what's happening to those people down there. Now, that's as tough as it gets. And the only way that this could possibly work would be for Trump and Sessions to make it tougher than that. I don't know. Torture? Trump likes that, so maybe that's what he's doing. Now, you look at these people and what these did, you know, the young moms with their toddlers and kids under the age of 5 standing there and basically, you know, accepting being separated from their kids because that cold bureaucratic horror of their kids being yanked from them, the pain that they are going through is still worth it. Because what they're escaping is so bad. This isn't just a bunch of people trying to take advantage of something. They're desperate. They're desperate people who are looking for some way to be safe, and they're willing to go through all this, including even having their kids taken away from them, if that's what it takes to keep those kids safe. That is what they're living with right now. So, you know, people need to understand, this isn't just some, you know, I don't know if people who don't live in places where there are a lot of Latinos who come over the border and they work here and they go back home. I mean, this flow over the border has been happening for centuries before right. There was a border. So there's nothing new in this. You know, people talk about how, oh, they need to assimilate. No, the white people need to assimilate to the fact that Latinos live in this country and always have. And they need to understand that. But even that isn't what this particular situation is. This situation at the border, and as you pointed out earlier, it happens every summer. People make this trek to try and get out, and they go through tremendous hardship all the way along the way. And then when they're stuck at the border waiting for these ports of entry that are so sacred, they're living in a place, these towns in Mexico where they're stuck for that period of time, are among the most dangerous towns in the world. And they're at risk of being raped, killed, robbed, everything, the longer that they wait there. So, you know, I mean, they'd rather deal with ICE. And you can understand that, right? I mean, I guess I would, too, if I was in their position.
Now,
and nothing Trump and Sessions does is going to change that.
And now, all right, I don't And I know, and you and I have talked about this in the past, that there is a compulsion in some quarters, both on the right and some quarters on the left, to discuss the Obama administration in this context. And I think, like, I think it is worthwhile and legitimate to tell people, if they were not aware of it, that the Obama administration was detaining and increased the amount of people they would detain. They would never separate families. Maybe in some instances the father would be removed, because it's much harder to house men in a facility with women and the kids. But they would never leave the kids without the parents. You know, if you came across with drugs or illicit thing, that's another category, it seems to me. And this was done as a deterrent, to the extent that Jay Johnson, the former head of the DHS, would go down to Guatemala and give interviews to make sure that this stuff was reported there. I think it's important to acknowledge that. Even though, and I think the reasons why the Obama administration did this, I think, were different, and it was not as obviously as horrific of a policy of basically orphaning kids, like, you know, having kids disappear, essentially. It's worth noting so that people understand why, if you set up a structure like this, it can metastasize into something ugly if somebody ugly gets a hold of the apparatus, right? Like, I mean, you know, we talked about this in terms of, like, national security stuff, but this is another example from an administrative standpoint. The jump for these people who work in ICE and whatnot probably was not as great of a leap as it should have been for them to be able to do it. I don't know if it would have made a difference. But we should acknowledge that, and I think there's a good argument too that Obama did it in service of some misguided political calculus, where he thought, like, oh, this is going to allow me to actually have the credibility with all of these racists that are going to allow me to, you know, to actually get some type of immigration reform, or to get DACA or DAPA or whatnot, and that may be the case. But I think it's important. I don't think we should harp on it too much, but I do think it's important for people to be aware of what the implications are, because one day, if we're lucky, Donald Trump won't be our president anymore, and there'll be reasonably rational, sane people who will be in charge of these things, and it's that much more incumbent as us as a citizenry to, you know, respond to these things and see the potential problems in them, not give anybody a pass because they might have good intentions or they might be a better person than Donald Trump. It's very hard to believe that most people who will be president going forward won't be a better human being than Donald Trump. Nevertheless, we need to be conscientious about that. And this is not in any way to equate these two things, but to show how, you know, you pave a road on some level. The vehicles that pass over it may be horrible. You know what I mean? And that's basically...
Absolutely. Well, you know, I mean, I think you and I talked about this even at the time, and I know that I wrote about it. You know, I mean, Obama was known as the deporter-in-chief. So, you know, among lefties, I mean, not, yeah. You know, the right wing, that was one of the things they liked about him. And, you know, they you know, pushed the envelope quite a bit on this, and I think for the reason that you said, which is that he continued to think that, you know, if I just, you know, reach out and, you know, try and meet them halfway on this, and I'll have credibility. And, you know, I think we've shown that is a completely fatuous approach to dealing with the right wing in American politics.
I hope you're right. Somebody should tell Chuck Schumer this.
I know, but I mean, you know, this is something. I mean, I remember all of us during that period, you know, the 8 years of Obama going, it's not going to work, dude. Right. It won't work with these people. You can't do it. It won't work. Because we'd been watching them closely, and there was this, you know, ongoing, you know, need on, you know, somehow, an impulse to sort of think, no, you know, but it's not a blue America and a red America. Yeah, it is. that's what it is. Let's just deal with that and go forward and try to fix the problem dealing with reality. But that, you know, I think toward the end of his term, he had a little bit more of that. But as this shows, this immigration issue, this was toward the end of the term. That they were confronting those, it was unaccompanied minors was the crisis at the time, which were mostly young teenage boys,
you know,
from the age of, say, 12 to 16 that were coming over the border. Their parents were sending them because they were in danger of being conscripted into gangs down in their home country or being killed. I mean, that was their choice. So these parents, imagine that. You've got kids. Yeah. Send your son off, you know, and just go, well, you know, 2,000-mile journey, good luck to you, son, but try to make it to safety, which is essentially what they were doing. And the right wing went nuts on that. And, in fact, that was a big impetus for, you remember the race in Virginia that upended Eric Cantor, the Republican
David
leader
Bratt.
In the House. David Bratt was largely on the basis of that immigration issue, which had been all churned up by the right-wing media at the time. So, I understand Obama's pressure on that. I mean, of course there was pressure. There's always pressure. That's never going to change. I mean, these people are relentless. And so you have to accept that that's going to happen. But this solution, as you put it, they experimented with a lot of stuff, and they experimented with family detention, which is what we're going to, what they're going to try to do here, if they can get a judge to get rid of the Flores settlement, which is basically what ended the family detention program under Obama. They were unable to do that, and they ended up having to go back to the humane policy, which is basically, you know, fill out the paperwork, do all the stuff you have to do, and then you'll come back for a hearing, and we'll decide whether or not you can have asylum. In the meantime, you go to your relative, you know, up in wherever it is, and we'll call you when we're ready. And by the way, the statistics show that over 90% of the people who do that come to their hearings. They want asylum, for crying out loud. They want to be legal. They don't want to be living in the shadows, and they have a chance to be legal if their asylum claims are approved. So they come back for that. That is not...
And often the asylum is rejected. I mean, that's just the reality of it. And now, you know, the Trump administration has narrowed the legitimate claims for asylum because they don't want even people to come in legally either. Right?
Like, obviously.
This whole process...
obviously. And they want... In fact, the immigration bills that are coming through Congress, one of the big things that is the sticking point and why the Democrats are lined up against it pretty much across the board. I mean, I've been surprised how well they've held on this, is that it really goes after legal immigration. And that is, of course, Jeff Sessions' great wet dream, is to end legal immigration. He's put that on paper. He said it outright. He put a plan out in 2015 as a guideline for the Republican people running for office in 2016. This is what we should do. And it was, he calls it a, quote, pause in legal immigration. Basically, it's shutting the doors to everyone, including workers, including, you know, doctors, including refugees from everywhere. It's just no more. We can't, because they won't, quote, assimilate, which is just absolute, utter nonsense. It's ridiculous. I mean, America is the one country on the planet, and I really thought, my whole life, I thought, you know, the one thing America's got going for it, that one thing that is its true strength, is that in an age of globalization where the world has gotten very small, people are migrating like crazy all the time, right? We had the capacity to be able to deal with that because our culture was essentially, with many, you know, problems over the years with nativism and what have you, but for the most part, we did this better than anybody, which was we were able to welcome people of different cultures, and we all kind of, you know, we just dealt with it because, you know, we'd go through our issues and then we'd relax and it would all be, you know, it was America. And we were good at that, and that meant we had this tremendous advantage economically, culturally, everything. Because places like Europe, where people have been living in little villages in France, you know, their great 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 grandfathers lived in the same village. For them, having Muslims come and live in their town is truly a jarring and unprecedented thing. That's just not true in this country. We've been through these waves of immigrants. We kind of have a sort of a muscle memory of how this goes. And you know, the real problem in this country is being manufactured by the right wing because they are afraid. They've become a white party. pretty much 100% white, and they are desperately afraid that they are going to be a minority, and they're never going to have political power of that.
I mean, and I think I would imagine most everyone listening to us, you know, knows that on some level. But when you think about, and maybe it's also just sort of like, you know, from where I sit, but the amount, the relentlessness that we hear in and not just coming from the right. I mean, like, there's sort of like this sort of like maybe sort of implication in the mainstream political press, like this notion of like Democrats, you know, and pandering to the left, you know, pandering to these different groups of people, and the Republican Party is so bound up in white identity politics that they're so bound up in it that it's almost like it's blotting out everything else. It's almost like the sun. Like, you don't notice the sun as you walk around unless you look up and say, like, it's just like, oh, it's just light. Like, the entire essence of their project is bound up in the fact that they are an all-white party. That is that. I mean, everything from, you know, every element of every move they make is bound up in that reality. They are so defined by that in so many ways. All right, let me just also, you mentioned the Flores settlement. Let me just make sure that people understand the dynamic here. The Flores settlement basically was saying that you could hold a family not in prison, right, but in detention, in sort of like a processing mode for 20 days. Like, if you can go through the process in 20 days and get all the paperwork done and whatnot, then you can do that. But you can't hold them any longer than that. So the way around that was for the Trump administration, we're going to put the parents in a criminal proceeding, which is outside the scope of Flores. That criminal proceeding is going to be a misdemeanor charge for like 91% of them. And then, because the parents are in a criminal proceeding, the kids are then immediately deemed unaccompanied. So There's no way to distinguish between kids who show up at the border without their parents, or kids who show up at the border with their parents, and the government, the U.S. government, takes the kids and then says they're now unaccompanied. And so now that they're unaccompanied, we're going to hold them and try and place them in foster care, or put them into, you know, a base in a military base, or we're going to sneak them out of the region by flying them on a plane and dressing them as a soccer team, or hide them in the dead of night in the Bronx or something. I mean, this is what's going on. It is. So disturbing. But this is the concern that people have, is that they're going to go, the court's going to reject them. Like, no, the Flores settlement says you cannot hold families for more than 20 days. And that's when Trump is going to say, well, in this case, we have to now put the parents back through a criminal proceeding or something to that effect. And I wonder, when we hear the stuff about the 20,000, beds that are being fashioned at these military bases, if that's not just sort of like a bluff or a threat. I mean, I don't know. It could be, but who knows?
Well, I mean, maybe it's just a plan B, you know, that if for some reason a judge does step in and say, okay, we're going to modify that settlement, which, by the way, just to even go a little bit deeper into that, that had been litigated for a decade, that Flores settlement, by the end of the 1990s, when they finally came to this conclusion, because these immigrants back in the 80s had been held in these horrifying conditions, these kids. Any unaccompanied minor that came in was held, and they were being raped and drugged, and the drugging part is still apparently happening. But, I mean, this was really bad. So they had child advocates and immigrant advocates, you know, litigate this all the way through, and they finally ended up making why it's a settlement rather than a law with the government, to ensure that kids who come into the country are, you know, decently cared for and not just thrown into some facilities with adults, and, you know, which is what had happened. Flores was a girl who had been raped repeatedly in a facility with a bunch of criminals. that she had been thrown into. So, you know, and that settlement has been modified over the last decade and a half as well, you know, as all these cases have been coming through, including through the Obama administration. You know, the idea here is that I think that the administration is probably playing it by ear. I think it's pretty obvious that they are as incompetent today as they were when they did the Muslim ban when they first came into office.
Right.
They've learned nothing. They don't know how to implement a policy. They just don't have the capability of it. I mean, we know that he has no conception of legislation and what it takes to negotiate any kind of a piece of legislation in the Congress. He just can't do it. He has a full Republican Congress. He has the credibility to make the right fall in line if he wanted to with the right wing. His people, you know, worship him, and he could do it. But he is too dumb. I really think it's just that. He doesn't know how, and he can't learn anything. So basically, he tweets. That's his form of governance. That's pretty much all and gives rally speeches. That's it. So they haven't learned anything, and I don't think that even Jeff Sessions, who probably has a more malevolent ambition with all of this than
right.
even Trump does, but I also think there's incompetence in his approach as well, because there was, you know, none of this could have been unanticipated, because as you just pointed out, the Obama administration went through this whole thing, right? They contemplated separating families. They went through the whole process. They did a full troubleshooting
right.
of how this whole thing would go. The Bush administration anticipated it too. I mean, it's not like this has never been thought of before, but because they went through the process, realizing how once you declare kids unaccompanied minors and put them into the system that way, that it was going that's the moment when chaos reigns, and there's no way. It's very, very difficult to put the families back together after that. Well, Sessions either didn't know that or didn't care, and didn't even bother to do something as simple as when you have a toddler or a kid under, you know, say 5 or 6 years old who really cannot speak for themselves in a court or anywhere else, you know, put some identity on them, you know, put a wristband on them with a,
right.
you know, with some kind of a barcode that matches to the parent. You know, I mean, that we're computerized, we're digitized in this country. It would have been possible to maintain the identity of children with their parents if they had even thought for 5 minutes about what would happen once they got separated. And I think that's really, I mean, maybe in Jeff Sessions' mind, this is, you know, this was fine with him to put everybody through this pain. But in the end, did Jeff Sessions really want all these, you know, Guatemalan kids on the taxpayers' dime
right.
being brought up in Illinois and Michigan? I mean, I don't think he really wanted that. He just didn't think of it. He didn't realize what was going to happen. And that is the same kind of thing that happened in the Muslim ban. They didn't think through what was going to happen if green card holders were on a plane and landed in the United States and suddenly were going to be turned back. It didn't even occur to them that, you know, it's just, I'm talking about simple logistics here.
Right.
Just, you know, nothing more than anybody with a, trying to, I don't know, make a you know, a toilet paper commercial would have to think through all the possible contingencies of any kind of operation that you try to put together. And they didn't think it through. They're just completely incompetent. That doesn't mean they're not malevolent, because they are that as well.
No, I totally agree. And it was clear, like, you know, we have video evidence that they were contemplating this, this exact policy back, you know, in March of 2017.
When
John Kelly was talking about it, and I don't know if they ever drew up plans, but yeah, it basically seems like this is you're talking basic logistics on how you would go about doing this. And it's interesting. It gives you a sense of just how fractured the White House is, how lacking in coordination, and it was probably Stephen Miller just, you know, saying,
yep.
finding his opportunity to push this thing, and a combination of Stephen Miller finding it and selling it to Trump from a political standpoint, because Trump supposedly thinks this is going to help him politically. And we should start talking about these sort of like second, third order stuff in a moment. But then Sessions who's probably desperate to keep his job, right? I mean, this happened in the wake of Trump getting even more angry at Sessions, and it's hard to know whether or not Trump was getting angry at Sessions to leverage him to do this type of stuff. I don't, or if Sessions was just like, "Oh, I'm going to go to I can crack the code here." And get on Trump's good side because he really thinks politically this is what he needs to give to his base. You know, and we should say that, like, even if you had a legitimate concern, I don't know what that really even means because we know what the data says about immigration. But even if this was a legitimate concern, you know, Trump could have just said, like, I'm gonna declare victory. You know, we were down for a little bit. We go back up. There's bound to be some ebb and flow. But, you know, if you compare where we are today as opposed to like 6 years ago in terms of immigration, we have really done.
Yeah.
I mean, because he's doing that with the economy, right? I mean,
exactly.
He said the other day, like, I inherited a really bad hand. The economy was falling apart. And, well, no, actually, if you look at the graph, it's like it is a slow, you know, all the indicators are going sort of like at the exact same rate and pace that they were the day he got into office. And he's able to do it in terms of the economy. I think they specifically felt like this. They completely, and let's do sort of like a move into the sort of the second order stuff, the politics behind this. They would have us believe that this is good for them and good for their politics. You know, this is the same sort of line about Steve Bannon saying, like, oh, we nailed it when we got those, snowflakes to go out to the airports. I think that's bullshit. I think it's like they say that retroactively to make themselves feel better or look better. And I think this week, it's going to take, you know, in 6 months, we may not remember this, you know, as a body politic, because that is the nature of American politics. But I think there's a lot of people, you know, whatever percentage of like determined hate there was for Donald Trump that is driving these special elections, I think, you know, a certain amount. I don't know if it's 5% or 10% or how you would measure it, whatnot. But the depth, you know, there are, you know, I think like this week has convinced a whole new set of people that, like, I don't care if there's a blizzard or a tornado or a hurricane on that election day, I'm going to vote. And I think as much as this was supposed to fire up the Republican base, I think the Democratic base just expanded a couple of points.
I really hope you're right. And, I suspect you are. I mean, the Trump administration, you know, look, we all know it's been a dumpster fire day after day after day. It's relentless. And, in fact, I think a lot of the people in this country are just kind of going, oh, God, you know, make it stop. I feel that way. I'm sure that a lot of people do. It's like, you know, the relentlessness of the chaos is overwhelming and exhausting. But the administration has been punctuated by some big crises that I think are illustrative of what this administration really is. I mean, there was Charlottesville. There was the Muslim ban in the beginning, really set the table for the rest of it. There was Charlottesville. Then there was Puerto Rico. And now there is this, and they are all about the same thing, right? I mean, this is just racism, authoritarianism, neglect. It is the creation of American carnage, which, you know, Trump very adroitly tried to pin on, you know, the rest of the country, and in fact is something that he and his people are doing, they're creating. But those four events, I think, are exactly what you say. They really crystallize for whatever decency is left in this country, that, you know, something fundamental, the crudeness of it, the overt racism and xenophobia of these things, and it crosses all boundaries. I mean, it's Muslims, African-Americans, you know, Puerto Ricans who are Americans, and now the border, and little brown children. And it's pretty clear what Donald Trump is about, right? I mean, he said a lot of things during the campaign, and I think a lot of people kind of, look, he's that guy at the end of the bar, he's just full of shit, right. You know, whatever, you know, he can't do that. I remember hearing a lot of people going, oh, come on, he can't do that. Well, yeah, he can. Now, granted, the courts have stepped in, there's the rickety infrastructure of our system is holding, but you know, it hasn't been that great. And look, there's 2,300 plus kids that are separated from their parents, and nobody knows whether or not they're ever going to be taken back. That's actual, real, direct human suffering. Puerto Rico, thousands of people died that are completely unaccounted for. I mean, this is the stuff that's happening. It's beyond symbolism. It's actually happening to real human beings. And I'm hopeful, you know, as you just said, that what this has done is just solidified this the resistance to actually, you know, doing whatever, you know, is possible to come out and vote against his party. And, you know, you and I have talked about this before, but, you know, it may be that Trump doesn't even care about his party. And I certainly get the feeling this week.
Too. Yeah.
That he does not care about the Republic. It's all about him. And he's even said it. You know, somebody said this was the most important election ever in history. Huh. What are they talking about? What, my election was the most important?
Right.
He says it.
And I think, look, I don't think, if I'm Donald Trump and I have no legislative agenda, okay, like I, and I
he
don't.
He doesn't know what a legislative agenda
right,
is.
Right,
I don't,
he doesn't have a legislative agenda. I certainly, you know, we got the tax cuts. This is, you know, from Donald Trump's perspective, and from the rest of the Republican Party's perspective, like all they got to do is hold the Senate and they will still, the entire ballast of the conservative movement, to the extent that any of them are not, you know, like actually sort of strategic in any way, has moved to the courts. They are packing these courts. I mean, they are just relentlessly at an unprecedented rate. They are packing the federal judiciary. And, and I'll talk about this either in the next couple of days, but it's quite clear that the Supreme Court now is, and we just had a Republican judge, a federal judge, who said like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau should be shut down. I mean, just like holy, and this is related to a ruling that was actually a pretty good ruling from an immigration standpoint, Pacoda versus Sessions. But most importantly, coming out of this is this dissent written by Kennedy, or maybe it's part of the majority, I should say, 5-4. But it indicates that he feels the courts can basically overrule government agencies. And this gets into the whole Chevron ruling. We'll talk about this later. But the point being that for the Republican Party, it very well may be at this point enough to control the federal judiciary for another 2 to 6 years in terms of appointments, including maybe another Supreme Court seat, because it is that powerful in our society. It is under the radar. And as far as Donald Trump is concerned, it's like he could just be like, as long as these guys don't, don't threaten to impeach me in the Senate, he's OK. I mean, because people have to the extent that they're going to go back and look at history. Bill Clinton was a lot more popular after he was impeached in the House than he was before. And Donald Trump has got to know that they're not going to impeach him in the Senate. They're not going to convict him in the Senate if it's a majority of Republicans, because they want to still get these judicial picks, you know, flowing through. They don't want to tie it up with any type of impeachment hearings and whatnot. And so I think that it's a perfectly rational perspective for the White House to say, like, we lose the House. That's great. You know, now when we go out there and say Democrats are obstructing, we could actually be, you know, not demonstrably telling a lie. And so I think it's quite possible that they don't care about this, that the only thing that they're working on right now is shoring up Donald Trump's base more than they are shoring up, anything to stop a so-called blue wave in the fall. And, I don't think that's an irrational strategy on their part, frankly.
Well, it's clear to anybody, aside from Trump himself, that anybody in the Republican Party who's trying to, actually preserve the Republican Party, i.e. Mitch McConnell and, Kevin McCarthy, that they can't control Donald Trump. He's not, he's not controllable. He's useless to them, except to the extent that he will sign legislation if they can get it through. And part of their problem is that they are, on a legislative level, completely out of ideas, obviously. They wanted to repeal Obamacare. They couldn't get that done. They might try it again if they win in November. But, they don't even really – that was just an electoral gambit. I mean, the idea that they would actually do that was probably always a long shot. They got their tax cuts. They got their huge military spending. What else have they got? I mean, they don't have a legislative agenda either.
They
it's
can't
not just Trump.
Right.
They don't have one.
They don't seem to be able to pass anything at all.
I don't even think they want to. At this point, it's kind of like they're coasting. What do they want that they don't already have? But there's a tremendous amount, as you say, setting themselves up for the future, the courts. I mean, they've been working on this for decades, right? I mean, this is the Federalist Society, and that whole cadre of very, very conservative Republican legal theorists who have been pushing for this particular moment for a very long time.
Yes.
So there's that.
And people should understand. They are anticipating losing control of the elected parts of the government. That's what this is about, right? Because during the Reagan years, they liked that Chevron holding because Ronald Reagan was filling these agencies. But during the course of Obama's years, and an awareness that demographically speaking, maybe not 4 years from now, maybe not 8 years from now. But when they start to look out, they're realizing we're the party of white people and we're in big trouble because the country is becoming less white, essentially. The courts for them are going to be the bulwark. They're going to be able to overrule any executive decisions. They're going to be able to overrule even legislative decisions. And this is their strategy for control, going 10, 20, 30 years out.
Well, and look at this. I mean, meanwhile, you've got Trump's administration. To the extent it's doing anything at all, it's taking a wrecking ball to the regulatory framework, right? I mean, it is just everything they can possibly. They just reversed yesterday or at some time this week the offshore drilling. Right, the ban on offshore drilling and drilling in the Great Lakes, and this stuff. I mean, every single thing that they could possibly get rid of, regulations, clean air, clean water, all the environment, workplace rules, every single thing they can think of, they are trying to get rid of those things and just leaving nothing in their place. And then, as you point out, they have the courts, they'll have a majority on the Supreme Court, God help us. I mean, they probably will. If Donald Trump gets kicked out in 2020 or 2024, whenever, the next time a Democratic president comes in and tries to reinstate all these things, then the courts will have this new doctrine of overruling anything that a Democratic president, any regulation that a Democratic president tries to institute. I mean, or implement. It's not just even instituting regulations. It's implementing congressionally mandated, regulations.
Yep.
And so this is going. I mean, this is going to be a court battle that's very, very substantial and significant for a very long time. And it is telling that they understand that the intellectual poobahs, to the extent there are any in the conservative movement, that it's really, this is a matter of survival for them. Their entire agenda is just, you know, exerting power wherever they can in order to survive. And that's it. And there's nothing more to it.
Digby, always a pleasure. I've always wanted to like do like a, hey, what can we expect next week type of a segment for this Friday, but it's not. It would be just like a weekly embarrassment of not not even being close. But
well, I just want to know what Melania is going to be wearing next week that, you know, sends a completely bizarre message, completely off message outfit. I don't, you know.
Let me just tell you how I headlined. Yeah, we haven't talked about that, but let me just let's tell you the headline that I wrote about it today. You tell me if you think it's off base. Melania Trump, morally bankrupt simp or morally bankrupt non simp?
Well, that is the question.
Right?
I mean, that is the only question to ask,
right?
Honestly.
How,
you know,
conscious is she aware,
from my standpoint,
of all the morally bankrupt things she's participating in?
I just can't even. But that one was so weird. I don't even really understand it.
Okay, let me tell you this.
All right,
I'm going to tell you the Larry Murphy theory. Larry Murphy he plays Teddy on Bob's Burgers, but he comes on the program, and Larry first texted me with this. He's like, have you seen this? And I'm like, yes. And he goes, all right, so Zara, which sells that jacket for $39, is a Spanish company. They are trying to take on Amazon. Just days ago, a day or two ago, the Trumps met with the king and queen of Spain. Now, the Queen of Spain, I went and looked into this. She has worn the Zara stuff occasionally. I'm quite convinced. And, well, they clearly got the jacket or the idea from the King and Queen of Spain. And that's the Zara stuff was probably around. And Larry's like, look, it's always about how they're making a dollar. And honestly, like, it would not surprise me. If you know, I would be curious if the King of Spain owns any holdings in Zara, or if somebody wasn't just like, you know, here, Melania, wear this, and you will have 2% of the company or something, like, or here's your stock options.
Wouldn't be surprised. The guy who owns Zara is one of the top five richest men in the world. I mean, he is. He's, you know, in Bill Gates territory. I can't believe it. It's like hard. People really like those clothes that much. I mean, he is. He's super rich.
I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for morally bankrupt simp as opposed to morally bankrupt non-simp in this. Like, I think it's quite possible their whole angle was just like, oh, Zara, we own 0.3% of the company, 0.03% of the company. We're going to get rich. And
right,
they just,
we'll get all those deplorables to go out and buy this stupid jacket.
Totally did not get that, like, oh, wait a second. People could read into this as I go out there. I'm quite convinced that a total incompetence and a morally bankrupt sense of getting every dollar they can out of this is Occam's razor in this instance.
I agree. I hadn't thought of that thing that she had met with the King and Queen of Spain just 2 days before, but that makes perfect sense. And she's so stupid. I mean, I'm sorry. I shouldn't be rude.
That's what I'm saying. Morally bankrupt simp as opposed to non-simp.
She is not a bright person. And she is, you know, I could see her, and I could see somebody too, you know, just sort of saying, hey, you know, Michelle Obama, who she loves to plagiarize, she used to throw on Banana Republic sweater sets with her $2,500 dresses, right? So just, you know, do that. That'll be cool.
I am quite convinced, and
sell some Zara.
Maybe she just really doesn't care.
I don't think they actually. I think it was really like, this is what the kids are doing. Then it's like, whatevs, and like nobody said, hey, but wait a second, is this a good message to send when you're going to visit these children? Like,
That's the thing about authoritarians, you know, they can be smart, but they don't have to be because
exactly.
They rule by brute force.
There you go.
I mean, it's
exactly.
A real Marie Antoinette moment, regardless.
Right? I mean, they're often kind of dumb.
Yep. All right, Digby, as always, thanks so much.
Hey, have a great weekend, everybody. Talk to you later. Bye.
Yeah, in fact, Jamie, there was somebody on Twitter who called her JV Marie Antoinette.
Nice.
JV Antoinette.
Yeah.
Maybe someday she'll move up to the big leagues.
Hey, folks, before we go, Jimmy Reed for Cake apparently is on vacation, and he wanted, this is what he wrote in. I just saw this. On vacation, but a quick message to those suggesting lyrics for Doors and other parody songs. Please remember to rhyme, and then, of course, legalize it.
Also, serious standards from Jimmy Reed for Cake.
Just a reminder, folks, my sister is involved in a fundraiser for Swing Left. The website is MakeTheWave2018.com. They are selling photographic prints. Each print is $100, which is a great price for the work of these photographic artists. Some of the prints are selling out, so you got to get on it. Only American citizens can buy the prints because this is going to campaigns. So check it out. It is at MakeTheWave2018.com. MakeTheWave2018.com. Also, just a reminder, this show relies on its members for its support. If you want to join the Majority Report and help support the free show, you can do so at JoinTheMajorityReport.com. You will get this show commercial-free, and you will get the fun half as well. But before we go to the fun half, we're going to call Film Guy Matthew and get a suggestion from him, and then I imagine hear about eBay stuff and other stuff. All right, here we go. We'll take a quick break and be right back with Film Guy Matthew.
It's just a bad movie where there's no crying, handing the keys to me in this red line where the lock that you locked in the suite says there's no prying. When the breath that you breathe in the street screams there's no science. When you look how you look, then to me that I cease lying and fall into silence. This is a life story, so there's no climax. No more new territory, so pull away the IMAX. In the slot that you sliced through the scene, there was no shyness. In the plot that you passed through your teeth, there was no pity, no faded. Film begins on a kid in the big city, and no cut to a costly parade that's for him.
Ladies and gentlemen, I mentioned Larry Murphy earlier, and he is a—he's not quite a not quite a regular, although he's I would say definitely a friend of show. But when we talk about regulars, when we talk about friend of show, there's perhaps no greater regular or friend of show, at least in terms of, you know, time, maybe not sort of depth. Terms of relationship, but in terms of time for this program, than someone who has his own theme song.
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing your streams. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such themes. Maybe I'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew,
You know, I got to say that that song has grown on me over the years. Maybe, you know, like I say, I would have thought, yeah, like the older I get, the more like sort of like, oh, the screaming and the boom, boom. But I think like when we got our new board, I actually heard it better. And
nice.
I picked up on the nuance. Film Guy Matthew, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to be here. I accept the idea that I am an inch deep but a mile wide in terms of the love I get from the Majority Report. That works just fine for me.
Well, you know, that has always been what I've always perceived myself, just in the way that I move through life, has always been an inch deep and a mile wide. And so I have,
it seems to work.
It's an attribute without doubt. Now, first off, I want to get
like
to
your, yes.
What's that?
I was going to say like you're the way you speak French. Comment allez-vous, Sam?
Très bien, merci. Et tu?
Yeah, there you go.
Right?
Yeah,
there you go.
Basically,
exactly.
You're better than I am.
There you go.
Anyway,
now listen, we have a clip that we're going to play, but before we get to.
Oh.
I like the way that you say that, as if you didn't realize you had sent it to us.
That's quite nice of you, Sam, to know that I had a clip to show. Wow.
All right. Well, let's play this. We'll do the clip first before we get into the really impressive work that I know you've been up to.
I would love to set up the clip, Sam.
But before we play it, why don't you set it up, Matthew? What is this clip that we're going to be looking at? So I should tell people who have been listening for the first time that you are what is known as a predator. You're both a producer and editor and director.
Yeah.
And you have directed projects. In fact, I know that you have acted in projects because I have hired you as an actor in projects. And,
that's right. You are responsible practically for my entire acting career. Thank you very much.
Well, yes. Okay. You're welcome. And so, all right, now you directed something. What is it?
So I've been working over the past few years with a comedian named Ted Alexandro, who's an extremely talented comedian, really great guy. And we did, if you recall, a few years ago, a web series called Teacher's Lounge, which featured
I don't remember being on
Ted
it.
And his.
I don't.
You
I
were
specifically
not on it. You were
remember
not, on
not
it.
Actually being cast in that, which was odd. But go ahead.
You know what's funny is you were on the short list of people to possibly think about hiring next time should we do another one.
Mm-hmm. I've been in that list many, many times. I got to tell you that, right?
Yeah. We went with Rob Morrow, but that's fine. Yeah, I know. That's happened to you before. So we did Teacher's Lounge a few years ago, and that was a web series where Ted and his writing partner, Hollis, who created the show, would be in a teacher's lounge, and different comedians would come in and out to do bits as teachers. You know, you had Jim Gaffigan as the nutritionist, Dave Attell as the school photographer, you know, bits like that. Todd Barry as the librarian.
Not
anyway,
familiar with any of their work, but go ahead.
Yeah, they're all good. Judy Gold was on it. She was in the first version, not one of the ones that I directed. She was in an earlier version. I know you're familiar with her work.
Mm-hmm.
And, So the most recent collaboration I had with Ted is Mary and I produced his new hour comedy special.
Oh.
And I directed and edited it in my capacity as a predator, although it's like predirector, right? There's because I directed it in there, too. And anyway, we're very proud of it, and it's going to be coming out very soon. And there's a teaser clip that we've released onto the web. And why don't you roll into that now?
Okay, so this is the teaser clip of that thing.
Fiance and I are getting married this October. She is in her very early 30s, and I am in my late 40s. They say a woman's sexual prime is her 30s, so she is in her sexual prime, and I am not. I'm past my prime. Like, do you remember when Shaq played for the Celtics? That's me. He didn't look like himself anymore. He had a hard time getting up and down the court. Some nights he was really an embarrassment. And I bet there were nights where Shaq's teammates got very angry at Shaq and said, like, Shaq, do you even want to play with us? Do you have any passion for the game anymore? Do you care? And I'm sure Shaq was like, no, guys, it's not that at all. I love you. It's just that I'm a little older now. It takes me a little longer to warm up. Maybe if you could just fucking be a little patient, Shaq probably said to them. And I just think it was very unfair of Shaq's teammates to treat him like that. He was a legend. He had done a lot in the game. He deserved better. And if you look back, Shaq had some really good games for the Celtics. Not every game. But on some nights, he looked like the Shaq of old. And I just wish his teammates could have appreciated that instead of harping on the nights that he had difficulty performing. I feel for Shaq is what I'm trying to say.
Now, Senior Class of Earth is the title. And I got to say, Matthew, that looks great. That is a great, I generally do not like the look of comedy specials because they usually use like these big, like annoying tracking shots that I just, you know, as if like
high key lighting, flat.
Yeah, this I thought was it looked great. I don't like the tracking shot because it's like, why am I interested in the perspective of someone who's like getting up to either leave or walk to the bathroom like that, like a moving shot of like that's not the way I enjoy comedy. That's when I'm running right to the bathroom. Why do I care about that shot?
But by that same token, you'd want it only in one spot where you're sitting the whole night. So there's a little give and take.
No. I could see being, a viewer of the show and wanting to know what the perspective of the audience is, the various elements of the audience. But
I really appreciate that feedback, Sam, because we very much looked at this special as a film, We wanted to make this look as cinematic as possible. We looked at a few other films as kind of reference to kind of get the look down, and we were very clear that we did not want to have audience reaction shots, because like you say, when I'm at the club, I don't turn around and look, hey, did he like it, was he laughing? So we kept it very much on Ted the whole time, and we had a tracking shot, but it was very minimal. It was more like a refresher kind of moment where you can kind of back out for a minute. But I really appreciate that feedback, Sam. And all credit to Mary and our DP, Larry Langton, who had a hand in setting the lighting design and getting our looks going.
So now let me ask you this, though. Like, why was Ted so interested in Shaq? I didn't get that.
I have no doubt that you greatly identify with the content of that clip. If you knew a little bit more about basketball, maybe you would get the analogy. I don't know what the problem is there, Sam. Maybe, I don't know, ask your intimate others.
Okay, I will make a note. I will make a note of that right now. Now,
this is not just for basketball fans. Yeah, go ahead.
Now, I should say the other work that you've been, I know you've been up to, which I was highly impressed with, was you at the last minute when I realized that I had no way of a formal record of my daughter's bat mitzvah, you came in and saved the day.
Well, in addition to being Matthew the film guy, I am also occasionally when good friends or you call and need me, I will be Matthew the bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah video guy. So I was happy to pitch in and do that.
And it was great because I had no way, because my daughter has, I think probably all parents are excited about their kid's voice, but my daughter has a great voice. And it was the only way that we were going to get that.
I thought she did an amazing, amazing job. I was very impressed with the way she handled herself, and it was quite a treat for me to witness that moment in you and your family's life.
And then you came to the party, and my understanding is we had like a little luncheon in the afternoon. We didn't we had an open bar, but we didn't really expect people to take as much advantage of it as you did. And
I was just the first to take advantage of it.
Somehow Matthew went from videotaping the bat mitzvah and got down to the, we had like a little luncheon. It was nice. It wasn't a big fancy affair at the last minute.
Tasteful.
The last minute, the Stephen Perry and Aerosmith canceled.
Yes, exactly.
So we just had to have iPad set up with some music, but somehow you got to be the first person in line for the drinks.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that I took a car there. I wound up there, and I just said, you know, what could really make this day worth it? Because look, I wasn't doing this for the money. I wasn't doing this for the acclaim or the fame. I was doing it for just for the joy of it. And adding vodka and tomato juice to anything increases the joy exponentially.
The Bloody Marys were fantastic.
They were fantastic. And I had a chance to chat up your good friend and my acquaintance, John Benjamin, about the details of his book, which I had just read, Failure is an Option. And I learned a few insider tips, which he did not necessarily include in the book, as to the identity of certain people in the stories that he told.
Really? Like which one? The threesome?
No, I did not go into that one. But it turns out that you were someone that he was hiding from at a certain point. I don't want to tell any tales out of school, but he tells this very harrowing tale of avoiding a bully. And I believe that bully was one Samuel Cedar.
Oh, my God. You know, here's the other thing that he doesn't tell about in the book, that he's a pathological liar. And there was no way I would be very skeptical of anything he told you of that ilk.
All right.
Oh, but
listen,
wait, you did make it. Oh, I did hear this story, too, because you made it into his book. And he didn't remember that it was you he was talking about.
We don't have to bring that up.
Wait a second. This is really funny. Now, I forgot about this. So Benjamin tells a story about shooting a pilot. And it was, you know, for a stage show he was doing called Midnight Pajama Jam, right?
Right.
Yeah,
here we go.
Benjamin tells a story about how he did this and he financed it. And, you know, he wasn't spending millions of dollars on this. I mean, he was barely spending hundreds, I think, if that. But at that time, that was, you know.
I was paid multiple hundreds of dollars to hire a crew.
And yeah. And I will say this. And I had said to Benjamin, like, dude, like, why don't you let me produce it for you? You know, John, he's gotten a little bit better, but when it comes to logistics or details or coordinating things or knowing how to get things done,
that may be going a little far, but
that's not his strong point. And by that, I mean, like, he's incapable of most of that stuff.
I was a creative type. I learned only in later years to get the details right. You know, again, this is going back like 15 years.
Yes. This is more than 15 years ago. Well, probably, about 15 years ago. And
all right. So 2001 or two.
He does. Well, that would have been 17, but he
there you go.
He does.
The math also I can't do.
He's doing Midnight Pajama Jam, which is a show that he would do with John Glazer, where it was like
which was genius, hilarious sort of fake children's puppet show as night. Sort of variety show.
Right. And I think I did my calves dance there?
You did indeed. You did indeed. Jeffrey Toobin, the calves man.
That's right. I would do, I did a bit where I would use a long pants unitard I would wear, and I would cut out holes for the calves, and I would actually go to the trouble of shaving my calves for this. And I would grease them up with baby oil, and then I would do a calf dance.
Is that when you started that routine that you've continued to this day?
Yeah, exactly. That's I just also explain what I do on weekends. And
right.
So the whole show goes off, and it was pretty well done. I thought the show was funny. The audience liked it, and then at the end, it turned out there was no sound.
Yes. I believe that is what happened. The sound was corrupted, let's say.
There was,
but you know what? all moved on. It's resulted in a great story for his book. It really, and this is what I said to him at the bar mitzvah.
So
I said, I gave you just another great story. I helped you succeed at failing, and that is my gift to you.
Matthew Film Guy is reading the book and is starting to read about himself as the guy.
Oh, my God. My face flushed. My heart beat fast. Thank God he just didn't say my name.
Because he didn't remember. He didn't remember that it was you.
That's right. Thank God he didn't. I had to remind him.
Yes.
Well, he actually said the sound guy, but little did he know there was no sound guy, and that was part of the problem.
Can you imagine reading about yourself in a book and then realizing the author didn't remember it was you? He was blaming for all that.
Yeah. No, I was listening it to on audio because obviously his voice. But when that part came, I was like, I got a little bit of that old fear feeling. But you know what? It's been years, so it's all we can all laugh at it, right, Sam?
I certainly can. I mean, I can almost. No, I totally. I feel like I can. I'm going to continue to laugh about it for a long time.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And every time you have, I know every time you have what's his name, who was the producer from FMU on, you mentioned it to him too. You love rubbing it in his face.
Yes, Sharp. Did he do that
Tom
one,
Sharply.
Or was that the he did the
he
next one?
He put up the money. He put up the money. If you recall, this is great stuff.
Right.
People are eating this up. Yeah,
Tom Sharply.
But yeah, Tom Sharply. So that was also his first foray into filmed comedy, I believe.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Nice try. Yeah.
Yeah. I started at the bottom. Now I'm here. Okay. So
yes.
These are learning processes.
Now, Matthew, what you also do, if people didn't know, is not just corrupt the sound of things in the past, but you also teach film to learning annex people, and you have an incredibly deep and wide, perspective on
right.
on film. What do you recommend we watch this weekend, Matthew?
So this weekend,
something uplifting, I'm sure.
Well, it depends on what you find uplifting, Jamie. it could very well
Jamie
be.
Jamie just nailed you. Yeah, good.
It could be argued that this is uplifting. It could be argued that this is down-putting. I'm not sure what the opposite of that is. But it's actually, to me, I found it extremely, extremely enlightening and just a total mind blower of a film. It's a classic Italian film from 1976 called Seven Beauties, directed by Lena Wertmüller, who this movie resulted in her being the first woman nominated for a Best Director Oscar. She did not win, but it was notable for that. It stars Giancarlo Giannini, who's an Italian actor that went on to do a zillion jillion movies, but this is him in his youthful Italian film phase. And it's, you know, so you got to take this with a grain of salt. It is bleak. It is chilling. But it is also absurd, breathtaking, disturbing, yes, but also ultimately inspiring because of the way it depicts the human condition. Now, the first 4 minutes alone is almost like an avant-garde documentary on the things that brought Europe to the brink of annihilation in World War II. The movie nominally takes place during fascist Italy in World War II era. The main character is sort of like a wannabe gangster in fascist Italy who winds up killing his sister's pimp out of like an ancient kind of misogynist sense of honor. And that sets him off on a dark trip through that entire era, like from an insane asylum to then he's forced conscripted into Mussolini's army. And then he winds up in a concentration camp. And really, the best stuff takes place in the concentration camp. Now, how often are you going to say that? Not a lot. But it's sort of a fractured narrative, so it jumps back and forth through time. But it features in this concentration camp one of the least erotic sex scenes ever filmed. And it's like sort of like I don't want to give too much away, but it's between the main character and the large woman who is the commandant of the camp. And he's trying to kind of use his sexual wiles on her to get by and get through the camp. But she totally turns the tables on him. It's actually one of the most amazing scenes just in general, I think, in cinema. And it has to be seen to be believed. But by that point in the movie, you're so like set up by this charming kind of rogue. I mean, he's a total douche, this guy. And you kind of go back and forth with your kind of charmed by him, disgusted by him. He's self-serving. He's petty. And yet you're kind of like rooting for him throughout this movie because he's kind of where you're linked in. Also, technically, this movie is a masterpiece. It's stark and beautiful imagery. It has beautiful images in certain places and then totally disturbing kind of too real, you know, unsugar-coated in others. And the various ways that she uses light and shadow, it shifts along the way as we kind of shift, like I said, these kind of ways you're identifying with the main character, Pasqualino. And it basically, to me, sums up what it is to be alive in a world of such depravity and darkness, you know, probably like working at the Majority Report. But, you know, it's definitely a work of art, a cinematic masterpiece, and it's available streaming on all your normal services.
Wow.
Sounds utterly heartwarming.
I got to say, I'm impressed that you could actually come up with a movie that you have, that you are so impressed with, and we've been doing this for so long. I mean, feels like the first movie you would recommend.
I know, and believe me, I have only just seen it myself in this class, and it was that just heart-stopping, and it's just, look, the cinema is long and is wide, and there are these masterpieces out there that even a film guy like myself has not come across yet. So that's why I'm out there doing the work for you people, so you can go find them.
Do you know how we find this movie?
Yeah, I think it's basically just Google Seven Beauties, and it's on all the services, iTunes, Amazon. I don't think it's like free on Netflix. It's probably like a $2 rental on most of them. It came out on, I think, Criterion Collection. It's a must-see movie. You know, it's part of the class I was teaching my Jewish senior citizens this time was like war movies. And I was trying to find war movies that were sort of off the beaten path, not just like fighting wars. And this took place during World War II, but it has such a kind of a depth and a breadth about the human condition that it's not, I wouldn't limit it to being called just a war movie. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those great works of art. And yes, it's, you know, it left all the nice old ladies jaw drop. I mean, this is a kind of a group of very curious and intellectually sort of nimble old ladies. But it was, my God, the conversation afterwards was just incredible.
Seven Beauties from 1975. Matthew Film Guy, great recommendation. I'm really going to try and watch that eventually.
Try hard.
I'm going to. And I'm going to watch my daughter's bat mitzvah very shortly once I find the link that you sent me.
So, try to watch that too. Oh, by the way, I just want to say Coco was perfect. So don't even say another negative word about Coco.
Coco?
The gorilla?
The gorilla.
Oh.
I
thought it was Como, wasn't it? Oh, Coco? Whatever. I mean, she's passed now. So I'm not spending any more
time. Don't say a bad word about Coco.
Matthew Film Guy, always a pleasure. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Talk to you later.
Bye. There he goes. Oh, don't forget, check him out at Langdon Boom. We'll put all his creds in there. Langdon Boom on Twitter. And he will probably tweet out a link to his eBay store. I don't know. It sounds like his eBay store might be, you know, he's been busy. Folks, reminder. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Jamie's podcast or co-hosted podcast, The Antifada, can be found at patreon.com/TheAntifada and, of course, on iTunes and everywhere else.
Yeah, we just released a new episode on Wednesday. Check it out. And we're also doing a collaborative episode this weekend with Brett from Rev Left Radio.
Ooh. What does that mean, a collaborative? So you both releasing it? Is that it?
Yeah.
Ah, dual release.
It's like Jetsons meet the Flintstones.
I've seen that. Mm-hmm. Yes. What do they call it? There's a specific word for that.
A crossover?
A crossover. Crossover
we're
episode.
We're doing a crossover show. It's going to be great,
cool.
Folks.
And Matt, you are, you release every other Saturday, is that correct?
The first and third Saturdays of the month.
And if my calculation is correct, the third Saturday of the month is was last week.
It was last week. So we did Rip Van Winkle. So catch up on that if you have not.
No, that's a literary hangover, folks. And you can get that through Patreon.
Stitcher, iTunes. Going to be on YouTube actually soon. I'm going to make video. Next week.
Really super aggressive about this.
I'm colonizing all formats and channels.
There you go. All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. You can join us by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. You can also be part of the program by calling us at 646-257-3920 or IMing the show through our app. We're going to update it soon, but pick it up now. It's free, majorityapp.com, majorityapp.com. See you in a moment.